from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, in any community that has undergone any kind of trauma, let alone disaster, there are landmarks, benchmarks, if I might use a Iraq War-related word. I think Prime Minister al-Maliki will recognize that one. Benchmarks on the road back. The first football game in the Superdome, for example, here in New Orleans. The first Saints winning season in living memory. The first Saints losing season since the disaster. For a return to normalcy. And right now, it's carnival season in New Orleans. One reason I'm here. And an acquaintance of mine, a person who was a guest on this program, I think about 2 years ago, Clancy Dubose, who is a local journalist in New Orleans and writes for the local weekly newspaper, wrote something this week that struck me as, well, yeah, it's probably the first person who's pointed this out. This is the first Mardi Gras since the disaster where nobody in New Orleans has said, why are we doing this? We're wasting valuable time, money, energy, whatever they think we're wasting. Nobody's saying that. It's back to, of course, this is what New Orleans does. Now, what is it that New Orleans does? If you're the normal non-New Orleanian, you probably get your information about carnival season here from Budweiser ads and or the Girls Gone Wild videos. Hey, he's in jail, isn't he? And maybe the Travel Channel. And yes, those they didn't make that stuff up. That stuff really happens. But it's just a little bitty piece of what goes on in the carnival season of this city that we're now back to doing without anybody saying, why are we doing this? So I thought today, since I have a parade to get to, that I'd basically spend much of this program letting you know what it's like, what else goes on here, what it is that makes carnival season something that New Orleanians have clung to no matter what and have returned to with such gusto this year. I think it was, well, I know it was 2 years ago, the first Mardi Gras after the city was flooded, thanks to the, well, you know who. But there'll be more about them. And people were, the people who were back, and of course it was a fraction of the city's population at that point, were spending their days gutting their houses, arguing with insurance adjusters, arguing with their mortgage lenders, hassling with everybody about everything. And they got to Mardi Gras that year, to Carnival, to give it its proper name, because Mardi Gras is one day and Carnival is an entire season, was an entire season where people got to come out into the streets after days like that, come out at night. Every single parade, with almost no exceptions, was dedicated to rude, sarcastic, nasty fun at the expense of the governor, the mayor, the president, FEMA, Michael Chertoff, Michael Brown, the Army Corps of Engineers, everyone who could possibly be associated with the disaster. And the great civic ritual, less than 6 months after the city had been flooded almost to the point of destruction, was for people to come out in the streets and see these beautifully decorated editorial cartoons rolling down their streets and be able to laugh at what had almost destroyed them. And at that point, I realized there's arguably no other city in the world where that would have been the civic ritual in the wake of that disaster. So that being said, I'll take you on a little tour of New Orleans at carnival time, at least as I know it, and also of the week, because we have had a week. So that's the agenda for Hello, welcome to the show.
Get ready to play Indian, y'all. They don't do this nowhere else but in New Orleans. Here come the wild chapel tutor. Yeah, we the uptown ruler. From way uptown, y'all, in the big 13. And we coming out Mardi Gras morning. Ain't giving no kind of warning. Gonna be the prettiest down in New Orleans. You can see Chief Jolly coming. You can hear his big gang coming. You can hear them coming all over the 13 wall. He shoot Kunafuna, make the ship a Una. No bow, y'all, and he won't be bald. Jolly be hooping and a hollering. Say we gon' meet everybody. Then everybody sing Indian Red. And then we head for the heart of the city. Yeah, y'all, we wild and pretty. We the uptown rulers, just like I said. Sing it. We the uptown ruler, yeah. We the wild chapatula, yeah. From way uptown, y'all, in the big 13. And we coming out Mardi Gras morning. Ain't giving no kind of warning. Gonna be the prettiest down in New Orleans. The wild man, he take off running. Spy boy, see another gang coming. Big Chief, stop on the avenue. Flag coming running on the double. Signaling that it might be trouble. Big Chief said, do like you wanna do.
As I dress in my suit, giving haters the boot. Straight up and wild up with my Mardi Gras crew. It's gangsta, I've been looking shy and pretty. Chief Jolly, little gang, showing haters the pretty. From the north to the south, from the east to the west. Chief Jolly and his gang sure know how to dress. So in case you don't know, we ain't fear nobody. Little gang, so never give a shout out to Jolly.
Y'all, but it feels so good. Coming through our neighborhood. Big Chief smoking that fire grain. Downtown towards Treme. Yeah, boy, we going all the way down. Then coming back home to the big 13. Yes, y'all, we the wild chapatula. Yeah, we the uptown ruler. From way uptown, y'all, in the big 13. We coming out Mardi Gras morning. Ain't giving no kind of warning. Gonna be the prettiest down in New Orleans. Come the wild chapatula. Yeah, we the uptown ruler. From way uptown, y'all, in the big 13. Come on now. And we coming out Mardi Gras morning. Ain't giving no kind of warning. Gonna be the prettiest town in New Orleans. Now get out the way, the St. John's are coming. Get out the way, nobody running. Get out the way, tambourine ringing. Get out the way, Indian singing.
From the French Quarter of New Orleans, Louisiana, from the epicenter of Mardi Gras in New Orleans, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition, this very special edition of the show. Probably the first thing to tell you about carnival season that you might relate to from your own experience is that one of the many activities that's going on in the days leading up to this time of benign craziness and frenzy in the streets is that people here are reminding themselves and sharing with each other tips on how to avoid the monstrous traffic jams. And you hear people in the stores talking about it. Well, I can't go there because it's carnival time. I don't even take the car. I take the bicycle, and that's the only way I get around. And it's of course, what modern people do in every city about every event. But it is one of the cardinal features of this season here is that last week, for example, I had waited too long to get a replacement ink cartridge for my printer. Well, there was no doing it on the weekend. No, not because the Office Depot is closed on weekends, but because it was carnival time and you can't get there from here. So it is, first and foremost, a traffic nightmare. Now, that basically helps you identify with a little bit more than, let's say, just watching the Girls Gone Wild videos. But the most amazing thing to me about carnival time here is that you see on the streets, in the parades, the evidence of days, weeks, sometimes months of people's effort and creativity. People have sat in their houses with glue guns or needle and thread. They don't buy costumes off the rack here, is what I'm saying. They make them. Let's put it this way. Even the straight people are creative here. You see what I'm saying? Now, last year, there's a parade where everybody can march in it. It's on Mardi Gras Day, as long as you're in costume. And my wife and I have made a practice of marching in that for several years because it's so damn much fun, and it's a great excuse to have champagne at 9 o'clock in the morning. Once a year, thank you. And last year, my costume was, I came as Mayor Ray Nagin. I thought that was a cute thing to do because the persona was not being used by anybody else in town. But of course, the problem was that nobody recognized me because they haven't seen him locally in so long. Had I done it in Houston, I would have gotten big laughs. But literally, you will see costumes that people clearly have been working on for months. And the idea that this city is, in the same way that a normal American city is gripped by a wave of shopping in the run-up to Christmas, that's so obvious and apparent that the pulse of that wave, a wave can have a pulse, is being taken daily in the business pages now. This city is gripped by a wave of creative frenzy leading up to whatever day people parade on. And it's not being covered by the business section because it's not business. So that is what you are, I think, moved to think of as you watch this stuff roll down the streets before you. When you talk about carnival with New Orleanians, don't by any means assume that everybody likes it. It's like any activity that draws a big crowd in any major city. There's a percentage of the population that whose attitude is, "Fooey, I'm getting out of here. Let me know when it's over." And that literally they leave town, partly because of the traffic and partly because of the influx of tourists with the traffic. And, they go to some other place, some other lovely place, and literally will not come back until Ash Wednesday, the day after Mardi Gras. And then there are people who just revel in it, just love it, just retain the awe and wonder at the strangeness of the event. And what's strange about it is, and I mentioned a moment ago, it's uneconomic base. There is no commercial sponsorship allowed in any Mardi Gras carnival parade. There is no, Budweiser buys so many ads around the country promoting it because they can't buy their name onto a float or into a parade. I think there's one parade that has some Clydesdales, and that's it. But it's against the rules for any of the organizations that put on parades to take commercial money. It's the members. It's the guys and gals in the particular organization ponying up the money. And then something so strange happens as to boggle the modern American imagination. People pay money to be in these organizations. Well, that's normal. And then people pay money to be on the floats. Okay. And then people pay money to either buy the makings of stuff or to buy the ready-made stuff, beads, cups, plush toys, other artifacts and souvenirs that they throw to folks in the crowd. Now, when you boil that down to the basics, they're throwing money away. They're taking the money and either buying or making things that there's a benign conspiracy to agree has some momentary value. So when you're on a float, people really want it. They're yelling at you and trying to draw your attention. And on one street in the French Quarter, on Bourbon Street, they're partially disrobing, partially, to attract your attention, to get these objects of momentary value. And the minute the parade is gone, the streets are filled with that stuff. And the trees are, the branches of the trees are hanging heavy with them. And all of a sudden, it's not items of value. It's junk, it's trash, it's debris. And the fever has broken. This is Le Show in New Orleans, and Barry Lee, ladies and gentlemen, from the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Now, it's probably only buried in terms of people around the country, because people in New Orleans already know this. The actual lead was that a federal judge threw out half of the lawsuit against the United States Army Corps of Engineers for the flooding. Remember the flooding? You heard about it. He threw out the half that involved the drainage canals on the west side of New Orleans, the ones that flooded the non-poor parts of town. Maybe you didn't hear about that. Anyway, he threw out that part of the suit because those canals, in his interpretation, were built as part of a flood control system, and the Corps has, under federal law, immunity for flood control projects. He kept the half of the lawsuit that relates to the notorious Mr. Go Canal, which is a navigation canal, and they don't have immunity for that. But that was the lead. Here's the buried lead. This is a federal judge, Judge Duval. What's Judge Duval's first name? Can we have research dig up Judge Duval's first name? Yes, research has reported Stanwood. Who would have guessed it would have been Stanwood? Anyway, Judge Stanwood Duval writes in his opinion, "Often when the king can do no wrong, his subjects suffer the consequences. Such is the case here. This story, 50 years in the making, is heart-wrenching. Millions of dollars were squandered in building a levee system with respect to these outfall canals, which was known to be inadequate by the Corps of Engineers, own calculations," unquote. The judge is saying the Corps of Engineers knew that the levee system they were building was inadequate. This just in. Ladies and gentlemen, F is for FEMA.
F is for FEMA.
Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
F is for FEMA.
This is from the San Diego desk. I was just chatting with one of my colleagues who lived in Poway, a San Diego County bedroom community, and was burned out in the recent fires. A FEMA representative came out to assess the damage at his home, and a few days later, a colleague received a report in the mail from FEMA that indicated his house has suffered, quote, insufficient damage, unquote. In fact, his house was burned completely to the ground. All that's left is the slab. F is for FEMA, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, a report from Congress this week indicated that FEMA had ignored warnings about the toxic nature of the formaldehyde fumes in the FEMA trailers. CBS News reported this week that FEMA leaned on a scientist at the Centers for Disease Control not to publicize his finding that there is no safe level for formaldehyde fumes in FEMA trailers. And of course, those tests on the level of formaldehyde fumes in FEMA trailers conducted a month ago, where are those results? I know that we don't have them here. Nobody has them. Well, they do have them somewhere. Somewhere in the bowels. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a weekend in which the adjective super is being thrown about with abandon. Today, of course, is Super Sunday. It's the Super Bowl. 2 days from now is Super Tuesday or Super Duper Tuesday or Super Tsunami Tuesday. And so the media universe is being dominated by those two events. I don't think the officials in New Orleans even contemplated the idea of changing the name of this year's holiday to Super Mardi Gras. In retrospect, yeah, still not a good idea. But so there is a feeling down here that any attention in this media-crowded year is worth something. So there was actual gratitude among some people I know when John Edwards ended his campaign the way he started it, using the Ninth Ward as a photo op background and using New Orleans as a lever for his campaign against poverty. Now, nobody hates poverty more than I do. Well, maybe poor people do. But it kind of amazed me that, first of all, that the news media crowd bought into John Edwards' assertion as he was taking leave of the stage, that his campaign had been all about fighting poverty. That was my lifelong mission, he said. That's what my campaign was all about. I watched the Democratic debates, unfortunately, and the Republican debates, unfortunately, And in the Democratic debates, I recall John Edwards' campaign was all about not being the guy that was beholden to the lobbyists. I don't recall him saying that he was the guy that cared more about poverty than Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. He was the guy who was going to fight the lobbyists and fight the special interests. But in the glow of his departure, the media bought the story. But apropos of the gratitude, now, people were grateful that John Edwards stood in the upper Ninth Ward, which he called the lower Ninth Ward. It's divided by a big canal. You can see it from a mile away, the big canal that divides. And talking about New Orleans as an example of poverty. Well, the poverty that almost destroyed New Orleans was not the poverty of its citizens, which was above the national average before the disaster. It was obviously, according to federal judge Stanwood Duval, the poverty of engineering expertise at a certain federal agency, name of which never passed John Edwards' lips. But we're grateful for, you know, keeping us. The attitude of we're grateful for anything that keeps us in the public eye, especially, you know, between the Super Bowl and Super Tuesday, would be ripe for ridicule had it not already been thoroughly satirized, thoroughly taken to its satirical furthest extent in real life by the mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, his invisibility, who recently said when asked about the murder rate in New Orleans, which, to be fair, is not as high as that in many other United States cities, but it's high. And he was asked about it, and he said, because it was being picked up by the national media, the stories of murders in New Orleans, he said, you know, anything that keeps the New Orleans brand out there is a good thing. So if you're in Dallas and see him, because that's where he lives, say hi for us. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
First up, speaking of mayors, Detroit's mayor, His Honor Kwame Kilpatrick.
I want to start tonight by saying to the citizens of this great city, I'm sorry. To all of you who have believed in what we've been doing here since 2002, to all of you who have believed in me and my leadership, to all of you who have stuck with me through very difficult times, to all of you who've prayed for me, I'm sorry. For the embarrassment and the disappointment, the events of the past few days have caused you.
Gee, Ray, you could use that same script. That's Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick apologizing and pleading for forgiveness from his family constituents. This was his delayed response to recently revealed racy text messages, I heart you, that contradict his sworn testimony that he did not have a physical relationship with a key aide. His wife, Carlita, was sitting at his side as he made the televised apology, and he apologized to her. I am the mayor, he told Detroit residents. I made the mistake, unquote. So nobody had the affair for him. We're now clear in understanding. ABC News reports that in an interview with Nightline, Hillary Clinton was asked about President Clinton's controversial comments about race and Senator Obama. She apologized for her husband. Quote, I think whatever he said, which was certainly never intended to cause any kind of offense to anyone, if it did give offense, then I take responsibility, and I'm sorry about that. Can you control him? She was asked. Of course, she replied. ESPN personality Dana Jacobson's intoxicated rant at the Mike and Mike Celebrity Roast at the Showboat Casino Hotel's House of Blues in Atlantic City has reportedly led to her suspension. She was suspended for 1 week after she slugged vodka straight from a Belvedere bottle and used vulgar language in reference to Notre Dame and its head coach, Charlie Weiss. ESPN declined to confirm Jacobson's suspension. During the roast, she came to the podium drinking vodka straight from the bottle. Her performance, full of mumbling and curses, was booed by the audience. She then made a public apology through a statement after the head of the Catholic League expressed displeasure for her alleged vulgar comments regarding Touchdown Jesus, the moniker for a statue of Jesus raising his arms on the Notre Dame campus in South Bend, Indiana. "I'm very sorry," Jacobson said. "My remarks about Notre Dame were foolish and insensitive. I respect all religions," she added. By the way, there's a statue of a similar statue in front of in the back garden of St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans, which is widely known among natives of this very Catholic city as Touchdown Jesus. Dateline Denver. Denver, Colorado, and Mountain View police apologized to members of the Hells Angels, settling a federal lawsuit over a 2005 traffic stop with a $14,000 payment to the bikers. The apologies are the second time Denver police have had to say sorry to the Hells Angels. The first time was in 2001 for a raid in the bikers' clubhouse where nothing illegal was found, and $50,000 was paid to settle that suit. So, the Angels are making good money by being in Denver. This time, David Lane, the lawyer, sued police over what he says was an unconstitutional traffic stop in Denver near the border of the other city. The lawsuit says eight Hells Angels were held at automatic rifle point for more than an hour and searched without probable cause. Deadline Paris, French bank Société Générale said the rogue trader that cost it more than $7 billion was something they were sorry for. The bank, France's second largest, apologized to shareholders in full-page newspaper ads after disclosing the fraud. Apparently the biggest ever carried out by one person. You go, babe. And finally, after a delay of 43 years, the State of Israel has officially apologized to the Beatles for retracting an invitation to perform there in 1965. Israel's ambassador to Great Britain presented the Museum of Liverpool's manager, the Beatles Museum in Liverpool's manager, with an official apology letter, including an invitation to Paul and Ringo to come perform during 60th anniversary celebrations of the State of Israel. Never too late, department. By the way, apropos, a listener pointed out a journalistic oddity. A couple weeks ago, we had a story from the Washington Post about the nation of Canada. Putting the United States on its list of countries that torture. The listener pointed my attention to the Reuters version of the same story, which included a detail left out in the Washington Post, i.e., quoting, "Canada's foreign ministry has put the United States and Israel on a watch list of countries where prisoners risk being tortured." The name Israel did not appear in the Washington Post story, for which I guess the Washington Post is sorry. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Oh, and speaking of torture, you do know that the new Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, went before a generally hostile Senate Intelligence Committee this week and refused repeatedly to say that waterboarding is torture or that it's illegal, although he did say that if it were done to him, he'd feel it was torture, becoming the second high-ranking intelligence official to share his feelings, but not his legal opinion. Mukasey said repeatedly at the hearing he didn't need to render a legal opinion because waterboarding is no longer employed by the CIA. See how it works? You do it, and then you stop, and then they can say, "We didn't say." Here's the gold. Here's the money right here. He expressed concern that if he did render a legal opinion as to whether waterboarding is illegal. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, as recently as 1968, the United States court-martialed one of its own soldiers for doing it. The United States put, I think, a Japanese soldier or two on trial for waterboarding as a war crime. Anyway, he expressed concern that if he did express a legal opinion about waterboarding, quote, "People who are hostile to us can look to that as an authoritative statement of how this country applies its laws and how it will continue to apply its laws," unquote. So if we don't say anything about whether it's legal or not, people who are hostile to us will just go, hmm. Of course, need to be pointed out again, Mukasey opted not to take the easier way out and define waterboarding as fun.
be legal, but it sure as heck makes me safer. And it may not yield useful intel, at least that's what they say. But it's a pleasure so rare, seeing captives gulp air. Let's go waterboarding, USA. Let's go. You can't get off if you want to. And it's really hard work, but for us it feels much more like play. If the tables were turned, we'd feel really burned. But let's go water.
When I say that some people in New Orleans are resistant to the charms of Carnival, it's not just about parking and traffic. There are those who point to the origins of the Carnival tradition and say things like, well, the membership of one of the oldest organizations that started to put on parades in the 19th century was pretty much the same as the membership of the local Ku Klux Klan chapter. And certainly, can't argue with that. But what's happened since then, of course, as the country and the city have changed, in the beginning of the 20th century, in response to the all-white, all-male nature of these organizations, which are called crews, the first all-black crew established itself. And only in New Orleans stance, not only decided to parade and to have floats and have a ball and all the rest of it, but decided that the members of the organization on the floats would parade in blackface. African Americans getting up at 5 in the morning to cork up. Just to poke fun at the whole. And they do to this day. Cork up, wear large kind of jokey Afro wigs and grass skirts, and have a place of honor second only in the Mardi Gras hierarchy to the ultimate parade, Rex itself, which is the most white and upper class of all Mardi Gras organizations. But now there are at least two all-women organizations. There are several mixed gender parading organizations, basically being against carnival because of the racist background of the organizations that started it is, well, it's like being against the U.S. Constitution because some of the people who wrote it owned slaves.
Well,
I know there's an argument there, too. Anyway, it's I'll give you another analogy while we're at it. Using New Orleans and its disaster as an example of why we should fight poverty is using the collapse of the bridge in Minneapolis as an example of why people shouldn't drive while talking on cell phones. Because I'm sure some of the people who died on that bridge were doing that. But now back to more about Carnival. You know, it's not just that people have their favorite routes to get places during Carnival time. People have their favorite places to stand or sit if they remember to bring a ladder. And if you talk to New Orleanians who do wax affectionate about Carnival, some of them will be very nostalgic for the old days when, you know, you'd bring families and kids, and forgetting that if you ignore the couple of areas, Bourbon Street and Canal Street, where tourists are invited to congregate. And so there are, of necessity, fences and barricades and crowd control structures in place. Because, yes, the New Orleans Police Department may have trouble catching murderers, but in crowd control, it really is the number one police department in the world. I don't think you can remember an untoward incident of crowd behavior or police behavior toward a crowd during Carnival, during Mardi Gras. I certainly can't. They're very good at it. But as I say, if you get away from those areas and you go to the more residential parts of town where the parades generally start their trek, their four-hour trek, well, my goodness, you see families with children. And no fences, no barricades. You can walk right up to the floats, talk to the people on the floats. That, in fact, having been on both sides of the affair, having ridden on floats and having stood in the street, that is one of the signal differences in these parades from any other parade you might have attended. The transaction between the people in the crowd and the people on the floats. Very often, they know each other. It's a small town. And you'll tell your friends, I'm going to be on float 8A. And they wait for that float to go by, then make a lot of noise. You throw the best stuff you have at them, and they're very happy, and they buy you, you know, a beer afterwards. It's not just during Carnival time that parades in New Orleans feature, as they're called, throws. During the St. Patrick's Day parade, for example, it's become traditional to throw cabbages, decorated cabbages, at the crowd. Just as during that, at one time, all-African-American parade called Zulu, they throw decorated coconuts. Well, now they, thanks to the insurance and legal advice, they hand them to the crowd. But a New Orleanian was quoted in a local paper this week as saying of his visit to California and attending the Rose Parade, I couldn't believe it that people would just stand there just to wave at a parade. Like, who goes to a parade if they don't throw you anything? So people do have their favorite spots. They have their favorite foods to eat. It is in a town that's laden with tradition. This is a time when the traditions come to the fore. And even though it's far too sugary for me even to take a glance at it. King cakes, these, to me, unfathomable concoctions are very popular this time. There's a whole range of foods that are eaten at this time of year. New Orleanians eat foods at a certain time for a certain reason. For example, they started eating red beans and rice because on Monday, because that was originally laundry day, and you needed to cook something that could basically cook for a long time without your attending to it, because you, the woman, were doing the laundry, hence red beans and rice. But it is a, as I say, a time-larded word chosen deliberately with tradition. And the other thing that's noteworthy to me, aside from the lack of commercial sponsorship about the parades, is how many of them either are rampantly satirical in the subject matter of the floats, or amazingly literary. far more allusions and choices of themes based on books than you would expect in modern America. Very few references to movies or TV shows. It reinforces the feeling you get so often in New Orleans, the feeling that you really are in another country. And a feeling that seems to be reciprocated by Washington. The vast majority of Mardi Gras songs, ironically, are not about the vast majority of Mardi Gras. They're not about the organizations that have the floats. They're not about one of the other remarkable parts of Mardi Gras, the parties that for the first 20 minutes or so might seem like ordinary parties in a city where I might have otherwise lived in, until a door opens, either literally or figuratively, and the live music starts. And no matter how fancy schmancy the party may be or how low down it may be, the music in the middle of the living room of the splendid or plain residence is funky enough to change the entire character of the party. But the music, the songs of Mardi Gras aren't about that either. The vast majority of Mardi Gras songs are about a part of the carnival that only a few people, relatively speaking, participate in or know about or understand. So come into the coven. It's the world of the Mardi Gras Indians. Songs like Iko Iko and Hey Pocky Way What are those syllables about? What are those strange, not French, not English, not any language any of us recognize? What are those about? The Mardi Gras Indians are several groups, maybe 20, 24 groups that, and you will hear different explanations of how this all started. So this is one of them. Didn't make this up, but may not be true either. Just like the rest of life. They started out as the outgrowth of possibly street gangs in the 19th century, or groups of newly freed slaves who were paying tribute to the other oppressed people, or taking inspiration from the other oppressed people on the continent, Native Americans. In either case, African Americans started masking, beading, feathering, dancing, chanting, and gathering as tribes of these Indians who were not Redskins, Mardi Gras Indians. And the ritual involved each member of the tribe hand beading, hand sewing, hand making an elaborate feathered beaded costume in colors decided on by the chief. And then on Mardi Gras morning, coming out as a tribe, walking down the street of their neighborhood, looking to confront other tribes in their neighborhood, or worse yet, tribes from other neighborhoods, and engaging in a semi-hostile contest of display to decide who was the prettiest. I know it sounds bizarre beyond belief, and that's what it is. And the tradition has survived to this day, even though the building of the federal interstate destroyed the grand boulevard of the African-American neighborhood on which much of this took place. It now takes place, even more bizarrely, under the 2-mile-long overpass that has that sits atop where that boulevard used to be. So under the overpass is where you'll find the Indians, so-called, doing that to this very day. And those songs, Iko Iko, Hey Pocky Way, are outgrowths of the chants that the tribes do as they perform these rituals. And it all, again, sounds like nothing from at least the North American continent. And yet that rhythm has pervaded rock and roll, rhythm and blues. It became known as the Bo Diddley rhythm, even though it started way before Bo Diddley. And those syllables have been chanted by the members of the tribes for now more than 100 years. Probably started in some, I'm guessing, some state of intoxication. But anyway, that's one probably fairly ignorant explanation of the phenomenon of Mardi Gras Indians. But there's a few documentaries that really capture the thing. And on a Mardi Gras afternoon, you can go see them if you're lucky. Their appearances are never that tightly scheduled or readily announced in the newspaper or on the radio. So it's a matter of luck to see them. And when you do, your Mardi Gras day is complete. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Le Show from New Orleans at Carnival Time. Hope I gave you a little bit of the flavor. Hope you caught some audio beads. The program returns next week at the same time over many of these same stations. And it'd be just like you being here for Carnival Time if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.